Highfields, New Jersey in 1932, 20-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. was put to bed at 7:30 p.m. His mother, father, and the household staff carried on with their night inside of the family home. When the nursery maid went to check on little Lindy at 10 p.m., she found his crib empty and a ransom note placed on the windowsill. He had completely up and vanished.
When stolen, he was dressed in a white sleeping suit. His hair is fair and curly. His complexion is light.
Make an example of the kidnappers and let the punishment fit the crime.
We have in custody the man who received the ransom money. His name is Bernard Richard Hauptmann.
That is the man.
But I am absolute innocent of the crime, the murder.
From Tenderfoot TV in Atlanta, this is Up and Vanished. I'm your host, Payne Lindsay. Today, we're talking about the new 20th Century Fox film, Murder on the Orient Express. But first, we'll get into the infamous case of the Lindbergh kidnapping, one of the inspirations for the story, Murder on the Orient Express. We'll be taking a look at how true crime, and the crime of the century to be exact, inspired Agatha Christie, one of the best-selling authors of all time. As you all know, I spent the last year and a half investigating the disappearance of Tara Grinstead, a teacher and beauty queen who had vanished from her home in Ocilla, Georgia. Ocilla is a tiny town, so when I went to investigate Tara's disappearance, I had to start with the assumption that everyone is a suspect, and the same went for the officials that investigated the Lindbergh kidnapping. Back in the 1930s, journalist H.L. Mencken coined this the greatest story since the resurrection. At first, this seemed like a big stretch to me, but the more research I did, the more I realized that this really was the crime of the century. Everyone knew about it, nationally and internationally, which is even more impressive considering this happened in 1932, when media outreach was way more limited.
Let the developments in the Lindbergh baby case start a new drive to wipe out the stain, not only of that wanton kidnapping and murder, but of all kidnapping and crime. Let the justice dealt for this baby's abduction serve notice. America demands death for all kidnappers and murderers.
The news blew up because Charles Lindbergh Sr., the father of the missing baby, was a world-famous American aviator, known widely for making a nonstop flight from Long Island, New York to Paris, France. The first solo transatlantic flight ever, and the first nonstop flight from America to mainland Europe. By age 25, Charles Lindbergh was an international celebrity. His accomplishment might not seem like much right now, but by 1927, Charles Lindbergh was the most popular person on the planet.
And now, my fellow citizens, this young man has returned. He is here. And as president of the United States, I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
When the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, Charles Lindbergh and his wife, Anne, were inside their house. Yet no one, not even the household staff, saw the invasion happen. Reportedly, Charles thought he heard a thud, but then didn't think anything of it. The perpetrator, or perpetrators, entered through the window in the nursery, using a homemade ladder that was brought to and left at the scene of the crime. The ladder was discovered near Charles Jr.'s bedroom window with a broken step, and the ransom note that was left only added more confusion to this case. The note itself was filled with bizarre wording, incorrect punctuation, and spelling errors, almost as if on purpose.
Dear sir, have $50,000 ready. $25,000 in $20 bills. $15,000 in $10 bills. And $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making anything public, or for notifying the police. The child is in good care. Indication for all letters are signature and three holes.
The signature was denoted by a strange symbol, a combination of colored, interconnected circles in three hole punchings. Due to the poor sentence structure and grammar, law enforcement guessed that maybe this was the work of an organized crime boss, or possibly someone of foreign descent. A prominent Bronx personality and retired school teacher named John Condon wrote a letter to the Bronx Home News, offering $1,000 if the child was turned over to a Catholic priest. Reportedly, he had received his own note from the kidnapper, designating Condon as the middleman for the kidnappers and the Lindbergh family. Subsequently, a $50,000 ransom payment was made, through John Condon, to the alleged kidnapper, who remained anonymous. However, in that $50,000, authorities placed gold notes that they knew were going out of circulation, in hopes that one day they'd be able to track down Charles Jr.'s captor. Even after the exchange, Charles Jr. was never returned. And then, tragically, the child's body was found in a grove of trees just a few miles south of the Lindbergh's home, about 2 months later. He had died due to head trauma.
The state contends that the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped at Hopewell, New Jersey on March 1st, 1932, and murdered. Little Lindbergh, then 20 months old, was taken from his nursery that fateful day. Despite the greatest manhunt in history, the baby's murder was not discovered until his little body was found here in the woods near his home 2 months later.
Because of the cause of death, the broken ladder, and the fact that the baby's body was found so close to the family property, it had been theorized that the captor fell from the ladder, causing the thud that Charles Lindbergh heard right after entering the nursery, and killed the baby almost instantly. Then the captor proceeded to extort the family for money anyways, just as planned. And in some ways, this looked like it could be an inside job. Firstly, on weekdays, their family usually stayed at their estate in Englewood, New Jersey. However, this particular week, they didn't return to their Englewood home. And instead, they were staying at their weekend home in Hopewell, New Jersey. And the kidnapper appeared to know about this change. Over time, the case became increasingly unusual. When a fingerprint examiner was brought to the scene, no usable fingerprints or footprints were found, leading them to assume the kidnapper wore gloves in some sort of fabric over their shoes, or perhaps there was inside help, and someone cleaned up the nursery methodically. This brings us to our first suspect, Violet Sharp. Violet was a maid at the family's weekday home in Englewood, New Jersey, and she's the one who received the phone call from Miss Lindbergh saying the family would be staying in Hopewell that week, not in Englewood. When questioned about her whereabouts, Violet lied to the police. Initially, she said she went to the movies, but she couldn't remember the movie's name or the name of her date. When questioned again, Violet said she went to a roadhouse with a man named Ernie Brinkert. However, Brinkert denied this. Reportedly, Violet was extremely nervous during this time period, and before she could be questioned again, she drank cyanide, killing herself. Tragically, Violet was later cleared of any involvement. When the baby went missing, there were five adults in the household: Mr. and Mrs. Lindbergh, the baby's nurse, the cook, and the butler. The only person unobserved during the kidnapping was the cook, Oliver Whatley. For a period of time, he was under suspicion too. However, Whatley died of peritonitis shortly after the kidnapping. Even Charles Lindbergh Sr. was a suspect. What if there never even was a kidnapper? After all, Charles Sr. was the only one to ever hear the alleged thud outside the family home that night. He also played a huge role in the management of the investigation, working closely alongside the police, to an extent that never would have been allowed without his celebrity status. Lindbergh also refused help from federal authorities, who were best equipped to ensure the safe return of his son. But one day, a German immigrant named Bruno Richard Hauptmann paid in a gas station using a gold note, one of the same gold notes that were taken out of circulation. Once the police got involved, they found a large amount of the ransom money inside Hauptmann's garage.
In this garage across the street from the Hauptmann home, $13,750 of the ransom money shown here was found. Two cans were stuffed with the gold certificates, and it was the passing of a gold certificate to Walter Lyle, a gas station attendant, that led to Hauptmann's arrest. Suspicious of gold notes, now withdrawn from circulation, the attendant wrote the license number of the car on the face of the bill. This latter, the only clue to the kidnapping, was homemade. And much is made of the fact that Hauptmann is a carpenter and could easily have built one similar to this.
New Jersey has rested its case, convinced that it has clearly established that the defendant Hauptmann came to the state of New Jersey on the night of March the 1st, 1932, with the ladder which he built, placed that ladder against the wall of the Lindbergh home, and went into the Lindbergh home and murdered the child.
But some people don't believe that Hauptmann was guilty, and there's still many alternate theories circulating today. Fingerprints never connected Hauptmann to the crime, in the nursery, or the ransom notes. They were able to lift 500 prints from the homemade ladder used in the kidnapping. But none of those fingerprints, including partials, matched Hauptmann's. And Hauptmann's wife always maintained that he was never involved.
Anna, the wife of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, tells you what she knows about the Lindbergh ransom. When did you first see the money, Mrs. Hauptmann?
I saw the money the first time when the detective drove me down to the garage.
Do you think your husband is guilty of kidnapping the Lindbergh baby?
I'm absolutely sure my husband had nothing to do with the Lindbergh kidnapping case.
But later on, some pretty damning evidence surfaced when a wood expert named Arthur Kaler was brought onto the case. He compared the wood used in the kidnapping ladder to the wood from missing floorboards in Hauptmann's attic, and they matched up. In addition to Kaler's discovery, a handwriting expert identified the script in the ransom notes as Hauptmann's, using documents such as old letters between Hauptmann and his friends.
The evidence is unmistakable. Mr. Hauptmann might just as well have signed each one of these ransom notes. So convincing to my mind is the proof that he did write them.
In my opinion, the fact is unmistakable that all 15 ransom notes were written by a man raised and educated in Germany.
And this board taken from the floor in the attic of the house where Hauptmann lived, a careful examination of the two shows that the grain of the two matches up perfectly. This is further indicated by the fact that both edges of this rail have been hand-planed, which shows that it was cut down from a wider board and was not manufactured that way originally. Furthermore, the nail holes in this ladder rail are of the same kind and size as in this board from the attic of Hauptmann's home.
Thousands of people swarmed the courthouse, trying to get a seat. This was the biggest, most publicized trial in American history. To put it in perspective, there were even Lindbergh trial souvenirs sold outside of the courthouse. Small toy ladders, dubbed Lindy ladders.
Look at this scene. A courtroom so packed that there's not an inch of space available.
There's grim faces, questioning faces, serious faces filling the courtroom. The court reporter and his assistants take down every word of the proceedings by machine.
In September of 1934, Bruno Richard Hauptmann was convicted of extortion and murder and sentenced to death in 1936.
The dramatic moment tonight, of course, was when Hauptmann walked into the electrocution chamber. His head was shaven till his skull looked white. He walked over, sat down in the electric chair as if he was going to eat dinner at his home in the Bronx when times were better. The guards dropped his arm just as he sat down, and as they put the helmet over his head, he looked up to see that everything was going all right. He died a very brave man.
An interesting fact, and maybe the most significant indicator of Hauptmann's innocence, was his refusal to take a lesser sentence and even more money, all in exchange for a confession. A newspaper offered him $100,000, which could be given to his wife. A New Jersey governor offered to commute the death sentence, lessening his penalty to life imprisonment. But still, Hauptmann didn't back down. He maintained his innocence. To this day, Hauptmann's conviction still raises many questions. Did he work alone? Was he set up? We may never know exactly what happened to baby Lindbergh. But in 2005, forensic examiners concluded that the ransom note was in fact written by Hauptmann, and that the wood on the ladder came from his attic. Inspired by the true crime events of the Lindbergh kidnapping, as well as her own experience aboard the Orient Express, Agatha Christie weaved together a story of murder, mystery, and suspense in her 1934 classic novel, Murder on the Orient Express. While writing the novel, the Lindbergh kidnapping had not yet been solved, so Christie was able to envision her own resolution through the fictitious kidnapping of Baby Armstrong that she used in her novel. On November 10th, 20th Century Fox is set to release Murder on the Orient Express, their feature film adaptation of Agatha Christie's best-selling crime novel. And recently, Fox invited me aboard the real Venice Simplon Orient Express to get a better feel for the atmosphere. So I headed off to Italy to catch the train to London.
Hey guys, it's Payne Lindsay here. I'm at the train station in Venice, Italy right now. I'm about to board the Venice Simplon Orient Express. Let's do it.
Buongiorno. Ticket right here. Ticket to paradise.
The Venice Simplon Orient Express is a luxury train service that runs from Venice to London. They use restored carriages from the 1920s and 30s, which gives the whole experience an authentic vintage feel. I felt like I had gone back in time. A butler dressed in full uniform, a bar car with a pianist, and a strict dress code on the train. No hats, no sneakers. As you can tell, it was a different world. And that's exactly what they were going for. Decadent, deluxe, and transporting. It was an experience I'll never forget. As the night went on, we made our way to the bar car. And that's when things got a little crazy. This is NBC's Al Roker and some other journalists gathered around the piano. I sat down with a conductor who told me about his experience on today's Venice Simplon Orient Express.
My name is Pascal Desrolles. I'm the general manager of the Venice Simplon Orient Express. So basically, I'm like a music conductor. I just supervise everybody and make the link between the railways and the operation, and making sure we have what we need to run the operation from an infrastructure standpoint and as well from a hospitality standpoint. But the way I like to call it is the entertainment business, because we're only here to make people happy. We're not here to do hospitality. We make people happy. We make people live their dream, and that's what we provide.
Why do you love the train so much?
Because it's unique. It's a time capsule that nobody else has in today's world. So basically, you're allowed to travel in a carriage which is 90 years old, that has been restored to the identical state as the original guests would have traveled. And back in my days of cabin steward, I did have guests who did travel on the original train or the original carriages and were back on board 20 or 30 years later. So it's very unique because it takes you back to a world that we all read in books, we all see in movies, but we have very little chances to experience.
It's like a time capsule.
It's a time capsule, totally.
Aboard the Venice Simplon Orient Express, I really felt like I was back in the 1930s. Everything was vintage, upscale, and stylish. And I have to admit, it's the perfect setting for a mystery thriller. In Murder on the Orient Express, 13 strangers are stuck on board this lavish train. And when tragedy strikes, everyone is a suspect. One man, Hercule Poirot, races against time to unpeel a suspenseful puzzle where morality is questioned, and people are not always as they seem. Poirot is Agatha Christie's most famous character and one of the most well-known fictional detectives of all time, appearing in Christie's very first novel back in 1920 and in over 80 of her novels and short stories ever since. While on the train, I sat down with Matthew and James Pritchard, the grandson and great-grandson of the late Agatha Christie.
I think there were two reasons why she wrote this book when she wrote them. The first was there was a very famous kidnapping case. Somebody called Charles Lindbergh lost his son, Charles Jr., in horrific circumstances in the early 1930s, and this made a great impression on her. And the second was her own trips on the Orient Express, which took place about a year or two after that. And I think the genius is, I mean, quite a lot of people, I suppose, would think that to write a mystery story about a kidnapping is not too unusual. Equally, it's not too unusual to write a book about a very enjoyable and interesting train journey you've been on. But to put the two together, that is where the genius of my grandmother, Agatha Christie, came in.
One of the reasons is that great fiction feels real, and I think the nods to real life events helps keep that keeps that feeling, even if the novelist's imagination then takes over, as in this. I mean, there is a basis of reality, but then obviously the genius is in the rest of the plotting and the denouement.
At home, we still have my grandmother's notebooks, I think 73 of them.
Wow.
With all the little things she scribbled in them, the things that she saw happening to other people in trains, snippets of conversations, little comparatively unimportant things. And then occasionally there's a big cross over the page, which means that she's used those in some story or another. So, I mean, the Lindbergh case is a very dramatic example of this, but most of them were very ordinary. And I think part of the genius is to pick up the ordinary bits of life and turn them one quick twist, and it becomes a murder mystery. I always tell people she was the best listener I ever met, and she listened to everything everybody said, much more interested in what other people were doing, including grandchildren, than what she was doing herself.
I always get accused by my wife of listening to other people in restaurants rather than her, and that, I blame my great grandmother, because I think that's what she did. I think she was always picking up stuff from other people around her, and that's kind of where some, as Dad says, some of the little bits come from, which just make it that bit more real. It is a privilege to be able to manage this extraordinary legacy. I mean, it's whatever it is, 66 novels, 150-odd short stories, a dozen-odd plays. You know, it's an extraordinary output for one person in one lifetime.
Aboard the train with me was a slew of reporters, journalists, and even Josh Gad, the actor cast as Hector McQueen in Murder on the Orient Express. We had a moment to sit down on the train and discuss his role in the movie and even his take on the true crime genre.
Hi, my name is Josh Gad, and I'm in the upcoming film Murder on the Orient Express, in which I play Hector McQueen. My character is a secretary to a character played by Johnny Depp named Ratchet, and my character's name is McQueen. And McQueen is somebody who seems like he's got a couple of secrets, right? Much like all the passengers on the train. They appear to be one thing, and very often a lot of them are more complex than they let on. And McQueen is somebody who's been working with Ratchet for the better part of a year, and he has a very keen eye for art and a very good sense for numbers. And so he becomes a useful asset to Ratchet.
How's it like going from comedy to a role like this? And is it different, or is your character funny in this movie?
It is different. I mean, each character that I play, brings its own set of challenges. And, you know, I trained as an actor, a dramatic actor, for 4 years in conservatory. So the comedy was almost something I accidentally fell into.
Yeah.
And then you start to kind of get cast in those roles. And I've always been looking for ways to kind of flip the switch a little bit, do things that are a little bit different than my audiences have seen. And Murder on the Orient Express is, you know, when I got that call, it was something that I was not only extraordinarily grateful for, because it is a drama, but the opportunity to work with, in my estimation, one of the greatest casts ever put together, at least for a modern film, you know, how do you not get excited about that? How are you not thrilled to not only be directed and work alongside Kenneth Branagh, but Dame Judi Dench, Johnny Depp, Michelle Pfeiffer, Daisy Ridley, my own college classmate, Leslie Odom Jr.
Awesome.
So, you know, all of that lent itself to an incredibly enjoyable experience.
Awesome. Why do you think people like murder mysteries so much?
Oh, man, I think that there's a lot of reasons. I mean, the whodunit of it all is always intoxicating, because the audience and the reader, in the case of these novels, always try to be one step ahead, right? And you are asking, hopefully, the same questions that the investigator is, in this case Poirot. You're trying to put the puzzle pieces together in your own mind, and so it makes the whole endeavor really fun. It makes it all really exciting because you're caught up in the cat and mouse game of it all.
Are you a fan of true crime at all? Do you know?
I am a fan of true crime. I mean, one of my favorite books ever is Devil in the White City, by Eric Larson. And you know, there's something about true crime novels that I'm sure for a lot of your audience it's the same. They spark the imagination.
Yeah. This new age of podcasting, this new medium, and journalism's changed so much on how you tell these long-form true stories.
Right.
I was curious what your thoughts are on the impact it's having on the way true crime investigations are happening and how it's affecting cases and what it can do. Like, stuff like Serial has changed it forever.
Yeah, I think that in the case of Serial, in the case of obviously your podcast, it is one more asset in the canon of these investigators. I'm sure that when you have access to something that you can listen to in your car on a daily basis or you can listen to at home, you then start to become engaged, right? You then start to go home and research. I know when I listened to Serial, I became an avid researcher myself. I wanted to know more and more and more.
Right.
And that consumption of information. And I think it even goes beyond just the podcast world. I think that there's this incredible fascination, whether it's, you know, the Netflix investigative shows or it's some of these other shows.
The Jinx.
The Jinx. Yeah. And look what came out of The Jinx.
Right.
And so I do feel like we're in this incredibly unique period. And I think that social media has a lot to do with that as well, because this can very often lead to solving the crime itself.
Believe it or not, yeah.
Joining Josh Gad is a star-studded cast including Johnny Depp, Penelope Cruz, Willem Dafoe, and Daisy Ridley. And the director of the movie, Kenneth Branagh, plays Christie's famous protagonist, Hercule Poirot. I got the chance to sit down and talk to Branagh and most of his cast, so stay tuned for future episodes featuring those interviews. And make sure you check out Murder on the Orient Express in theaters November 10th.
Would you mind if I join you?
You're the world-famous detective, Hercule Poirot. Avenger of the innocent. Is that what they call you in the papers?
And you are innocent?
You're fun.
A passenger has died. He was murdered. The murderer is on the train with us now. And every one of you is a suspect. So, let us catch a killer.
A man was rummaging around my cabin in the middle of the night.
You are certain it was a man?
I know what it feels like to have a man in my bedroom.
What did you think of the dead man?
You leave her out of this.
Did he have enemies?
Pick a number.
The real killer is right here. One of you people.
We're surrounded by lies.
I'm sleeping here, where everyone can see me. And I can see everyone.
Who takes up the knife?
Cannot trust a one. Another one?
Christie's novel and 20th Century Fox's new movie are testaments to how true crime inspires fiction. True crime stories influence some of the most compelling fictional stories to date. But is the truth stranger than fiction? That's up to you to decide on November 10th.
Thanks for listening, guys. Today's episode was mixed and mastered by Resonate Recordings. If you want to improve the quality of your podcast or start a podcast of your own, go to resonaterecordings.com and get your first episode produced for free. Thanks, guys. I'll see you soon.